Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to start this lecture with reading two or three lines from the 21st chapter of the Book of Revelations. This chapter contains a description of the New Jerusalem, and it finishes like this: "And the street of the city was pure gold, as it were transparent glass, and I saw no temple therein, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple thereof." In the same way, of course, there was no temple and no religion in the ordinary sense of the word in Eden. Adam and Eve didn't require a temple and didn't require the ordinary apparatus of religion, because they were in a position to hear the voice of the Lord as he walked in the garden in the cool of the day. And when we look at the book of Genesis, we find that religion, in the conventional sense of the word, began only after the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the garden. And the first record of it is the building of the two altars by Cain and by Abel. And unfortunately, this is also the record of the first religious war. Cain, if you remember, was a husbandman, a vegetarian, like Hitler. And Abel was a herdsman and a meat eater. And they were divided passionately, evidently, on their different occupations and gave them a kind of religious absoluteness, with the sad result which we all know. And then in the third chapter of Genesis, there's a mention of a new phase in relation to religion. This is after the birth of Seth, who was Adam's third son. It says there in the third chapter, and to Seth, to him also was born a son, and he called his name Enos. Then began men to call upon the name of the Lord. Well, this evidently is the beginning of the what may be called the conceptual kind of religion, the sort of liturgical side on the one hand, and the verbalized side of religion. And these two sets of references at the beginning of the Bible and at the end illustrate very clearly an important point, that there are two main kinds of religion. There is the religion of immediate experience, the religion, in the words of Genesis, of hearing the voice of God, walking in the garden in the cool of the evening. The religion of direct acquaintance with the divine in the world. And then there is the religion of symbols, the religion of the imposition of order and meaning upon the world through verbal or non-verbal symbols and their manipulation, the religion of knowledge about the divine rather than direct acquaintance with the divine. And these two types of religion have, of course, always existed. And we have to discuss them both in this context. Now, let us begin with religion as the manipulation of symbols, as imposing order and meaning upon the flux of experience. In practice, we find that there are two types of symbol-manipulating religions. There is the religion of myth, and there is the religion of creed and theology. And now, myth is obviously a kind of non-logical philosophy. It expresses, either in words, in the form of a story, or very often in the form of some visible image or even in the form of bodily movements, in the form of a dance or a complicated ritual, it expresses some generalized feeling about the nature of the world and of man's experience in regard to it. And the myth is an unpretentious thing in this sense that it doesn't claim to be strictly true. It is merely expressive. It is expressive of our feelings about experience. And though it is a non-logical philosophy, it is very often a very profound philosophy, precisely because it is non-logical and non-discursive, because it permits in the story or in the image, the picture or the statue, or in the dance, it permits the bringing together into a single single expressive whole, of a number of the disparate and even apparently incommensurable and incompatible parts of our experience. It brings them together and shows them at one viewing as an indissoluble whole, exactly as we experience them. In this sense, it is the most profound kind of symbolism. Let me take a single example of this. The myth of the Great Mother, which runs through all the earlier religions, is still very powerful in the religion of Hinduism. Well, the myth of the Great Mother in almost all these religions shows the mother as simultaneously the principle of life, of fecundity, of fertility, of kindness and nourishing compassion, but at the same time as being the principle of death and destruction. In Hinduism, Kali is at once the infinitely kind and loving mother and this terrifying goddess of destruction who has a necklace of skulls and drinks the blood of human beings from a skull. And of course, this picture is profoundly realistic, because obviously if you give life, you must necessarily give death, because life always ends in death and requires to be renewed through death. So that we see here, I think, a very good example of this profound non-logical philosophy which can be expressed in mythological forms. And of course, when we ask whether myths are true or not, this is quite an irrelevant question. They just are not true, as I said before. They are simply expressive of our reactions to the mystery of the world in which we live. On the other hand, before I go on to the other type of symbolic religion, I think it's worth mentioning a point here, that in practice we find these earlier non-logical mythical religions very frequently associated with what have been called spiritual exercises, but which are in fact psychophysical exercises. We find very often that these religions make great use of the body in their religious approach to the world. We find them making use of chant and dance and gesture and getting a genuine kind of revelation from this. It's as though the releasing of the physical tensions which we build up by our anxious and ego-centered life, the releasing of them through these physical gestures constituted what the Quakers called an opening through which the profounder forces of life without and within us can flow more freely. And it is very interesting to see, even within our own tradition, how this this occasional letting go and organizing the body for religious purposes has had profound and very salutary influences. For example, why were the Quakers called Quakers? For the simple reason that they quaked. When they were, the early Quakers were renowned for this, that their meetings very frequently ended with the greater part of the assembly indulging in the strangest kind of violent bodily movements, which were profoundly releasing and which permitted, so to speak, the influx of the spirit to pour into them. And as a matter of history, the Quakers, as long as they quaked, had the greatest degree of inspiration and were at the height of their spiritual power. And we have the same phenomenon, of course, in the Shakers. The Shakers shook, just as the Quakers quaked. And we see in the contemporary religious movement called Subud precisely the same phenomena, the coming upon the assembled people of these curiously violent and involuntary physical movements, which produce this kind of release and permit for many people, I don't think they do it for all, but for many people, they undoubtedly permit the influx and the flowing through of deeply powerful spiritual forces. And here I would like to quote the remark of a eminent French Islamic scholar, Émile Dermégem, where he says, modern Europe, and of course modern Europe includes modern America, is almost alone in having renounced, out of bourgeois respectability and Gallican Puritanism, the participation of the body in the pursuits of the spirit. In India, as in Islam, chants, rhythms, and the dance are spiritual exercises. And I think this is a profoundly true and important remark. And it's interesting to see in the sort of these rather isolated corners of our own tradition the way in which this harnessing of the body to the needs of the spirit, this permission to use the body that the spirit may be left more free. It is interesting to see how these small corners of our tradition have illustrated the fact, which is so manifestly clear when we study the history of the Oriental religions. Now, we have to go on now to consider the problem of religion as the other kind of symbol system, not as the system of myths, but as the system of concepts, of creeds, of dogmas, of beliefs. This is a profoundly different kind of symbolism. And it is the one which in the West, of course, has been much the most important. Now, the two types of religion, the religion of immediate experience, of direct acquaintance with the divine, and this second kind of symbolic religion, have, of course, coexisted in the West. The mystics have always formed a minority in the midst of the official symbol-manipulating religion. And this has been a symbiosis, but a rather uneasy symbiosis. The members of the official religion have tended to look upon the mystics as difficult, troublemaking people, They have even made puns about the name. They have called mysticism, mysticism. Schism in the Spanish, S-C-H-I-S-M, in the sense of that this is not a clear doctrine, it's a foggy doctrine, it's an antinomian doctrine, it's a doctrine which doesn't conform easily to authority. And they have disliked it in consequence. And on their side, of course, the mystics have spoken not exactly with contempt, because they don't feel contempt, but with sadness and compassion about those who are devoted to the symbolic religion, because they feel that the pursuit, the manipulation of symbols is simply incapable in the nature of things in achieving what they regard as the highest end, the union with God, the identification with the divine. You get in William Blake, who was essentially a mystic and who was apt to express himself in rather violent terms about those he disagreed with, he speaks in these terms of the relationship between the two types of religion. He has this little couplet where he says, "Come hither, my boy, tell me what thou seest there." And the boy answers, "A fool tangled in a religious snare." Now, within the tradition of Western Christianity, the mystics have been assured of a tolerated position by the perpetration at an early stage in Christian development of what is called a pious fraud. About the 6th century, there appeared a series of Christian Neoplatonic volumes under the name of Dionysius the Areopagite, who was the first disciple of St. Paul in Athens. And these volumes were taken to be almost of apostolic value, inasmuch as here was the first disciple of St. Paul, and if he said this, this must be guaranteed on the highest apostolic level. In point of fact, of course, these books were written either at the end of the 5th or at the beginning of the 6th century in Syria, and the author, the unknown author, merely signed this the name of Dionysius the Areopagite to these books in order to give them a better hearing among his fellows. He was a Neoplatonist who had adopted Christianity and who combined the doctrines of Neoplatonic philosophy and the praxis of ecstasy with Christian doctrines. Well, the pious fraud was extremely successful because the book was translated into Latin in the 9th century by the early philosopher Scotus Erigena, and thereafter it entered into the tradition of the Western Church and acted as a kind of bulwark and guarantee for the mystical minority within the Church thereafter. And it's not until quite recent times that the pious fraud was recognized for what it was. But meanwhile, it's interesting to notice the odd, ironical quirks of history that this curious bit of forgery played a very important and, I feel, very beneficent part in the Western Christian tradition. Now, we have to consider now the relationship between the two types of religion, the religion of immediate experience and the religion primarily concerned with symbols. In this context, there's a very illuminating remarks by Abbot John Chapman, who was a Benedictine and one of the great spiritual directors of the 20th century. He died, I suppose, about 25 or 30 years ago. And his letters, his spiritual letters, are works of very great interest. And he was obviously a man who had a profound mystical experience himself and was able to help others along this same path. Well, he remarks in one of his letters He says that he remarks on the great difficulty of reconciling, not merely uniting, mysticism and Christianity. St. John of the Cross is like a sponge full of Christianity. You can squeeze it all out, and the full mystical theory remains. Consequently, for 15 years or so, I hated St. John of the Cross and called him a Buddhist. I loved St. Teresa and read her again, over and over again. She is first a Christian, only secondarily a mystic. Then I found that I had wasted 15 years so far as prayer was concerned. And now quickly let us say what he meant by the word prayer in this context. He did not mean, of course, petitionary prayer. He was speaking about what is called the prayer of quiet, the prayer of waiting upon the Lord in a state of alert passivity and permitting the deepest element within the mind to come to the surface. Now, Dionysius, in his mystical theology and his other books, had constantly insisted upon the fact that in order to know God, to become directly acquainted with God rather than knowing about God, one must go beyond symbols and concepts. These are actual obstacles, according to him, to the immediate experience of the divine. And empirically, this has found to be true by all the spiritual masters, both of the Western and of the Oriental world. Let me quote a striking example of this. It comes from the writings of Jean-Joseph Olier, who was a very well-known spiritual director of the 17th century and a product of the Counter-Reformation and a product of the revival of mystical theology which took place in France in the time of Louis XIII. What he says is this: the holy light of faith is so pure that compared with it, particular lights are impurities, and even ideas of the saints, of the Blessed Virgin, and the sight of Christ in his humanity are impediments on the way, in the way of the sight of God in his purity. This, of course, seems, particularly from a Counter-Reformation theologian, a very strange and daring statement, and yet it does represent, I think, a perfectly clear restatement of what had been said again and again by the mystics of the past. What he calls the sight of God in his purity is, psychologically speaking, the mystical experience. This is one thing. And belief in propositions about God, belief in dogmas and theological statements is, and in liturgies inspired by these statements, is something, of course, entirely different. Now, in this context, I would like to quote the words of an eminent contemporary Dominican theologian, Father Victor White, who is a particularly interesting writer, inasmuch as he's both a theologian and a psychiatrist, or psychotherapist. He's worked a good deal with Jung and is very well acquainted with modern psychological theories and practice. What he says is, Freud's conception of religion as a universal neurosis is not entirely without truth and value. And if once we have understood Freud's terminology, we must remember that for Freud, not only religion, but dreams, unbidden fantasies, slips of the tongue and of the pen, everything short of an unrealizable ideal of complete consciousness is somehow abnormal and pathological. But theology will also confirm that religion, in the sense of creeds and external cults, arises from man's relative unconsciousness, from his incomprehension of and disharmony with the creative mind behind the universe. Such religion, in theological language, is the result of man's fall from original innocence and integrity, his remoteness on this earth from divine vision. Now, the religion of direct experience of the divine has been regarded as the privilege of a very few people. I personally don't think this is necessarily true at all. I think that practically everybody is capable of this immediate experience, provided he sets about it in the right way and is prepared to do what is necessary about it. But in fact, this has been taken for granted, that the mystics represent a very small minority among a huge majority who must be content with the religion of creeds and symbols and sacred books and liturgies and organizations. And of course, with beliefs, this is with faith in the form of belief. Now, belief, of course, is a matter of very great importance. There has been, in recent years, published one of these great bestsellers, which is called The Power of Belief. And this is a very good title, because belief is a source of power, a very great source of power. It has power for the believer himself and permits the believing person to exercise power over others. It does, in a sense, move mountains. But of course, this belief, like any other source of power, is in itself ethically neutral. It can be used both for evil and for good, for just as well for evil as for good. And of course, we have seen in our own time this terrifying spectacle of Hitler very nearly conquering the entire world through the power of belief in something which was not only manifestly untrue, but also profoundly evil. So that we see then that this tremendous fact of belief, which is so constantly cultivated within the symbol-manipulating divisions, religions, is essentially an ambivalent thing, that it can be both good and bad. And the consequence is, of course, that religion as a system of beliefs has always, in point of history, been an ambivalent force. It has given birth, of course, to the saints. It gives birth simultaneously to the Sister of Charity and to what the medieval poets called the proud prelate, the ecclesiastical tyrant. It gives birth to the highest form of art, and it also gives birth to the lowest form of superstition. It gives birth, it lights the fires of charity, and it also lights the fires of the Inquisition, lights the fire that burned Servetus in the Geneva of Calvin. It gives birth to a St. Francis or an Elizabeth Fry, but it also gives birth to a Torquemada or to a Kramer and Sprenger, the authors of the Malleus Maleficarum, the great handbook of witch hunters, published about the same year that Columbus discovered America. It gives birth to a George Fox, and also gives birth to Archbishop Laud. So that we see that this tremendous force has always been ambivalent, precisely because of the strange nature of belief and the strange capacity of man when he embarks on his philosophical speculations for coming up with extremely strange and fantastic answers. Myths, on the whole, have been much less dangerous than theological systems, precisely because they are less precise and less have less pretensions to being the absolute truth. Where you have theological systems, there is a claim that these propositions about events in the past and events in the future and the structure of the universe are absolutely true. Consequently, a reluctance to accept these propositions is regarded as a rebellion against God, worthy of the most condign punishment. And we see that, in fact, these systems have, as a matter of historical record, been used as justifications for almost every act of aggression and imperialistic expansion in the past. There is hardly a single large-scale crime in history which has not been committed in the name of God. And this is a terribly painful and troubling thing, I think, when one is studying the history of religion, to see how easily this tremendous force can be used for the most undesirable purposes. And it, of course, was summed up many centuries ago in the hexameter of Lucretius, where he says, "Tantum religio potuit suadere malorum," such great evils was religion able to persuade men to commit. But he should also have added, "Tantum religio potuit suadere bonorum," such great goods also could it persuade men to. But nevertheless, the good has clearly had to be paid for by a great deal of evil. And now, this sort of strife-producing, controversy-producing quality of religion as a system of theological symbols has brought about not only the jihads and crusades of one religion against another, it has produced an enormous amount of internal friction within the same religion. The odium theologicum, the theological hatred, is notorious for its virulence. It has, and the religious wars of the 16th and 17th century were a degree of ferocity which really passes all belief. They were unbelievably horrible. The 30 Years' War, for example, which were exacerbated by religious differences. And in this context, I think we should remember what Professor Hofstadter said in his lecture, that we are accustomed now to say, oh, what great evils naturalism as a philosophy has brought upon the world. But in point of historical fact, supernaturalism has brought about just as great evils and perhaps even greater ones in the past, so that we mustn't allow ourselves to be carried away by this kind of rhetoric. Now, I mentioned before this extraordinary capacity of philosophers and theologians to produce fantastic ideas, which they then dignify with the name of dogma or revelation. And as an example of this, I would like to cite a few facts about the history of one of the fundamental ideas in Christianity, the idea of the atonement. Such information as I have here is based upon the excellent article, the long essay on the subject in Hastings's Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics. The essay is by Dr. Adams Brown, who at one time was professor of theology at the Union Seminary in New York. And he has set forth the history of this doctrine very lucidly and summed it up very cogently at the end. Now, let me quickly go through this, because it illustrates, I think, very clearly the dangers precisely of this kind of symbol-manipulating religion. Now, in the earliest period of Christianity, Christ's death was regarded either as as a covenant sacrifice, comparable to that of the sacrifice of the comparable to the sacrifice of the Paschal Lamb in the Jewish religion. There is some gospel authority for this, or else it was regarded as a ransom, exactly comparable to the price paid by a slave to obtain his freedom, or the price paid by a war prisoner to be released. Both these ideas occur in the, are hinted at in the Gospels. Well, then later on, there came the notion that Christ's death was the bloody expiation for original sin. This was based on a very ancient idea that any wrongdoing required expiation by suffering on the part of the sinner himself, or on the part of a substitute for the sinner. For example, in the Old Testament, we read that David's sin in making a census of his people was punished by a plague which killed 70,000 of his subjects, but didn't kill David. The expiation was by a substitute, and this idea was taken over in the later post-gospel theology. Then in patristic times, we find a profound difference between the theologians, the Greek theologians, and the Latin theologians. The Greek theologians were not primarily concerned with the death of Christ. They were concerned with the life. The death was, so to speak, a mere incident in the life. And their view of the atonement was that it existed not to save man from guilt, but to save him from the corruption into which he had fallen after the fall of Adam and Eve. And consequently, the life was therefore more important than the death. Irenaeus says that Christ came and lived the life of man in order that man might live a life comparable to his, and that this was the saving quality of the atonement. Among the Latin fathers, the stress was entirely different. Here the idea was that the man was being redeemed not from corruption primarily, but from guilt. He was redeemed from the punishment which had to be inflicted upon him for the sin of Adam. And whereas the Greek theologians regarded God as primarily absolute reality, absolute spirit, the Latin theologians regarded God in the with the mind of a Roman lawyer as the governor and lawgiver. And consequently, their theology tends to be in legalistic terms. Now, the doctrine was developed slowly. We get in St. Augustine a continual stress on the appallingness of original sin and of the fact that the guilt is fully inherited by all members of the human race, so that an unbaptized child must necessarily go directly to hell. He has a terrifying passage where he says that the floor of hell is paved with infants less than a span long. Well, this view went on and was developed over the centuries. And then there was a long period of discussion about the question of the ransom. To whom was the ransom of the death, Christ's death, paid? There were many theologians who insisted that the ransom was being paid to Satan, that God had handed the world over to Satan and that he wished to take it back again, and therefore had to pay this enormous price to Satan for the privilege of taking it back, of taking man back from the grip of Satan. On the other hand, there were theologians who insisted that the ransom was being paid to God to satisfy the honor of God, that God had been infinitely offended, and that the only reparation for an infinite offense was an infinite satisfaction, and that man himself was incapable of giving an infinite satisfaction, consequently that the only possible satisfaction was therefore the death of the God-man, of Christ. Well, it was the latter view which prevailed in the more or less official doctrine as it was formulated by St. Anselm in the 12th century, that the reparation was paid for the satisfaction of God's honor. And we may remark incidentally that Anselm spoke about the overplus of the satisfaction by this infinite person being killed, constituted a kind of fund of merit which could be used for the absolution of sins. And it was on the basis of this doctrine that the medieval church enlarged its practice of selling indulgences, which led in due course to the Reformation. So that again one sees the curious consequences of these different doctrines. Well, then we come to the Reformation, and we find that Calvin felt that retributive justice was an essential part of the character of God, and that Christ was actually bearing the punishment which was due to man, that every sin had to be punished, and that Christ, and this is the words he used, he bore the weight of divine anger and experienced all the signs of an enraged and avenging God. Well, these views were modified by the Arminians and the Socinians and by Hugo Grotius in the 16th and 17th century, and have given place gradually to a more ethical and spiritual view in modern Protestantism. But then, now I would like to read this passage in which Professor Adams Brown sums up the whole of this very strange history. He says, "The atoning character of Christ's death is found now in its penal quality as suffering, now in its ethical character as obedience. It is represented now as a ransom to redeem man from Satan, now as a satisfaction due to the honor of God, now as a penalty demanded by his justice. Its necessity is grounded now in the nature of things, and again is explained as the result of an arrangement due to God's mere good pleasure. The means by which its benefits are mediated to man are sometimes mystically conceived, as in the Greek theology of the sacrament, sometimes legally, as in the Protestant formula of imputation, and still again morally and spiritually, as in the more personal theories of recent Protestantism. Surveying differences so extreme, one might well be tempted to ask, with some recent critics, whether we have here to do with an essential element in Christian doctrine, or simply with a survival of primitive ideas whose presence in the Christian system can constitute a perplexity rather than an aid to faith. But, adds Professor Brown, the differences we have discovered here are not greater than may be found in almost every other Christian doctrine. And the reasons for these differences in particular doctrines are to be sought in fundamental differences in men's conception of God and of his relations to the world. Where God is thought of as absolute spirit, the atonement is conceived as the Greek theologians conceived it. Whereas in the theology of Roman Catholicism and earlier Protestantism, God is conceived primarily as governor and judge, legal phraseology seems the natural expression of religious faith. Where ethical doctrines come to the fore, as in modern views of the atonement, ethical and spiritual language is used. Now, this, I think, indicates very clearly the extraordinary difficulties we are up against when we embark upon a systematic theologization of experience, a transference of experience into conceptual and symbolic terms. It obviously leads to difficulties of the most extraordinary nature, and the advantages which certainly accrue from sort of accurate theological expression seem to me certainly offset by very grave disadvantages, which the history of organized religion clearly indicates. Now, what has been, as a matter of history too, the attitude of the proponents of religion as immediate experience towards the religion expressed in terms of symbols? In an extreme form, Meister Eckhart expresses this attitude. He says, "Why do you prate of God? Everything you say about God is untrue." Now, here we have to make a short digression on the use of the word truth in religious literature. The word truth is used in at least three senses, three common senses. It's used as synonymous with reality. We say God is truth, which means that God is the primordial fact. It is used in the sense of immediate experience, where in the fourth gospel it's said God must be worshipped in spirit and in truth, meaning with an immediate apprehension of divine reality. And finally, it's used in the common sense of the word as correspondence between symbolic propositions and the facts to which they refer. Eckhart, of course, was a theologian as well as a mystic, and he would not have denied that truth in the third sense was to some degree possible in theology. He would have said that some theological propositions were certainly truer than others, but he would have denied that there was any possibility of the final end of man, the union with God, being achieved by means of manipulating these symbols. And this insistence on the inefficacity of symbolic religion for this ultimate purpose of union with God has been stressed by all the Oriental religions too. We find it in the literature of Hinduism, in the literature of Mahayana Buddhism, of Zen, of Taoism, and so on. And I would like to read one or two of the statements made by the Oriental mystics. Here is one, I think it's by Hui Neng, where he says, "The truth, indeed, has never been preached by the Buddha, seeing that one has to realize it within oneself. And again, what is known as the teaching of the Buddha is not the teaching of the Buddha." Again, it has to be an interior experience. And there were even Zen masters who prescribed that anybody who used the word Buddha should have his mouth washed out with soap, because it was so remote from the immediate goal, the goal of immediate experience, which was proposed in this branch of Buddhism. Then you get another paradoxical phrase. "What is the ultimate teaching of the Buddha? You won't understand it unless you have it." And then the author goes on to say, "Meanwhile, don't be so ignorant and puerile as to mistake the pointing finger for the moon at which you're pointing." And he says that the habit of imagining that the pointing finger is the moon condemns one condemns all efforts to realize oneness with reality to total failure. Well, this has, as I say, been the regular attitude of mystics at all times, and above all in the Orient, where Oriental philosophy has been in one respect profoundly different from Western philosophy. Oriental philosophy has always been what I may call a kind of transcendental operationalism. It starts with somebody doing something about the self, and then from the experience attained, going on to speculate and theorize about the significance of the experience. Whereas all too frequently, above all in modern Western philosophy, you get a philosophy which is pure speculation, which is based upon theoretical knowledge, and ends only in theoretical conclusions. This, as I say, has never been the case in traditional Oriental philosophy. However, there have been many exceptions to the rule in the West, above all among the mystics, who have insisted just as strongly as their Oriental counterparts on the necessity for direct experience and on the inefficacy of symbols and of the ordinary discursive use of the mind. St. John of the Cross says categorically, all that the imagination can imagine and the reason can conceive and understand in this life is not and cannot be approximate means of union with God. And the same idea is expressed by the great Anglican mystic of the 18th century, William Law, who says, to find or know God in reality by any outward proofs or by anything but by God himself made manifest in you will never be your lot either here or hereafter. For neither God, nor heaven, nor hell, nor the devil, nor the flesh can be any otherwise knowable in you or by you, but by their own existence and manifestation within you. And all pretended knowledge of any of these things without and beyond this self-evident sensibility of their birth within you is only such knowledge of them as the blind man has of the light that has never entered into him. This, as I say, is the Western equivalent of this constant repetition which we find in all Oriental literature. And now, very briefly, we have to discuss what is the mystical experience. I take it that the mystical experience is essentially the being aware of, and while it lasts, being, while the experience lasts, being identified with a form of pure consciousness, of unstructured, transpersonal consciousness, lying, so to speak, upstream from the ordinary discursive consciousness of every day. It is a non-egotistic consciousness and seems to underlie, it is a kind of formless and timeless consciousness which seems to underlie the consciousness of the separate ego in time. Now, why should this sort of consciousness be regarded as valuable? I think for two reasons. First of all, it is regarded as valuable because of the self-evident sensibility of value, as William Law would say. It is regarded as intrinsically valuable, just as aesthetically the experience of beauty is regarded as valuable. It is like the experience of beauty, but much more so, so to speak. And it is valuable secondarily because, as a matter of empirical experience, it does bring about changes in thought and character and feeling, which the experiencer and those about him regard as manifestly desirable. It makes possible a kind of sense of unity, of solidarity with the world. It brings about the possibility of a kind of universal love and compassion. It's that kind of unjudging love and compassion which is stressed so much in the Gospel, where Christ says, judge not that ye be not judged. And there's a phrase which was used by St. Catherine of Siena on her deathbed, which again stresses this point with extreme with extreme significance, where she says, with great force, she said, for no reason whatever should one judge the actions of creatures or their motives. Even when we see that it is an actual sin, we ought not to pass judgment on it, but have holy and sincere compassion, and offer it up to God with humble and devout prayer. The mystic, I think, is made capable of this kind of love and is able to understand organically such portentous phrases, which for the ordinary person seem extremely difficult to understand. I mean, phrases like God is love, or yet, yea, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. These phrases become comprehensible to one who has passed through this kind of experience. And then there are other fruits of this experience. There is certainly an overcoming of the fear of death, a conviction that the soul has become identical with a kind of absolute principle which expresses itself in every moment in its totality. And there is an acceptance of suffering in the self, and a passionate desire to alleviate suffering in others. There is, in a word, in Buddhist terms, there is a combination of what the Buddhists call prajna paramita, which is the wisdom of the other shore, with mahakaruna, which is universal compassion. That, as Eckhart says, what is taken in by contemplation is given out in love. And this is, as I say, the value of the experience. And as for the theology of the experience, when it is felt necessary to make a theology of it, this is profoundly simple and is summed up in the three words which are at the base of virtually all Indian religion and philosophy: tat tvam asi, thou art that. The sense that the deepest part of the soul is identical with the divine nature, that the Atman, the deep soul, is the same as Brahman, the universal principle. Or in Eckhart's words, that the ground of the soul is the same as the ground of the Godhead. And this idea, of course, has been expressed in many forms. You get it in the idea of the inner light, the scintilla anime, the spark of the soul. The scholastics had a technical phrase for it, the synteresis. And there were many, many expressions of this idea. Now, very, very briefly, I must just touch on the means for reaching this state, and I shall have more to say of this in the final lecture on the realization of human potentialities. Here again, it's been constantly stressed that the means do not consist in mental activity and discursive reasoning. They consist in what Roger Fry, speaking about art, used to call alert passivity, or in what a modern American mystic, the great teacher of reading to the world, Dr. Frank Laubach, has called determined sensitiveness. I think it's a very remarkable phrase, that you don't do anything, but you are determinedly sensitive to letting something be done within you. And one has this expressed by some of the great masters of the spiritual life in the West. Saint Francois de Sales, for example, writing to his pupil, Saint Jean Chantal, says, "You tell me you do nothing in prayer, but what do you want to do in prayer except presenting your nothingness to God?" And Saint Jean Chantal, in one of her letters, says, "I have come to see that I do not limit my mind enough simply to prayer, that I always want to do something myself in the matter, wherein I do very wrong by allowing the fear of being ineffectual to enter the state of prayer, and by wanting to accomplish something myself, I spoil it all." This attitude of the masters of prayer is in his final analysis exactly the same as that adopted by the teacher of any psychophysical skill. The man who teaches you how to play golf or play tennis, or a singing teacher, a piano teacher, will always tell you the same thing. You must somehow combine activity with relaxation. You must let go of this clutching personal self in order to let this deeper self within you come through and perform its, one may say, its miracles, which you interfere with. And in a certain sense, one can say that what we are doing all the time is to get into our own light. We eclipse our deeper selves by our superficial selves, and so don't permit this life force, this light, whatever you like to call it, which is empirically, as we discover if we let go, is an empirical fact within us. We don't permit it to come through. And in effect, the whole of the technique of proficiency in every field, including this highest form of spiritual proficiency, is a diseclipsing process, a process of getting out of our own light and permitting this thing to come through. And of course, if anyone doesn't want to formulate this process in theological terms, he doesn't have to. It is possible to think of it strictly in psychological terms. I myself happen to believe that this deeper self within us is in some way continuous with the mind of the universe, whatever you like to call it. But as I say, you don't necessarily have to accept this. You can practice this entirely in psychological terms and on the basis of a complete agnosticism in regard to the conceptual ideas of Orthodox religion. An agnostic can practice these things and yet come to gnosis, to knowledge, and the fruits of knowledge will be the fruits of the spirit, love, joy, and peace, and the capacity to help other people. We see that then there is really no conflict between the mystical approach to religion and the scientific approach, simply because one is not committed by it to any cut-and-dried statement about the structure of the universe, that one can remain completely an agnostic in regard to the orthodox conceptualizations of religion, and yet, as I should say, come to the gnosis and finally exhibit the fruits of the spirit. And as Christ said in the gospel, it is the tree shall be known by its fruits. Thank you.